let me proceed to talk about marriage. I'll start out by saying a few things about polygamy, which is one subject I'm sure everyone realizes is made a topic of controversy when discussing Islam and women. I think the important thing to understand about Islam in general is that there are no rights without duties, and no duties without rights. As far as polygamy is concerned, it is subjected to very strict regulations, which I might say, as far as I know, in the world, among the many systems that practice polygamy, Islam is the only one I know of that regulates polygamy. So if one wanted to study this particular issue in some depth, what one would need to do would not be to compare Islamic polygamy with Christian monogamy, but to compare Islamic polygamy with, say, Confucian polygamy, which is very different. In any case, let me just run over the conditions for polygamy. First, it says, if you fear you cannot do justice to the orphans, then marry women who please you, 2, 3, or 4. But if you fear you can't treat them fairly, then 1. So the first thing we notice is that polygamy is for a social purpose. If you fear you cannot do justice to the orphans, it has to do with pulling together rifts in the fabric of society. And it historically, it may be noted that this passage about polygamy, permitting polygamy under these strict conditions, was revealed after a battle in which many of the Muslim men were killed, and therefore many women were left widowed and many children left orphaned. Now, when it says if you fear you can't do justice to them, then 1, some people today say that this is a de facto recommendation for monogamy, because you can't do justice to more than one woman. And in fact, they cite this subsequent passage of the Quran which says, you cannot treat women the same, even if you try. Now, I feel that if this were meant to be an abrogation of the earlier injunctions, it would be known that this was an abrogating verse. No, it's not. Some people say it's a contradiction. Some people say that it means, after all, that monogamy is favored. Well, let's look at it this way. I mean, part of it is a translation matter. How can you treat different people the same? Is that treating them equally? No, it's not. People are different. If you have 4 wives, they're all different. They have different personalities. So I think we could read this passage better if we double read it. If we didn't just satisfy ourselves with glossing the word once, we could actually read it to say, you can't treat women fairly by treating them all the same, even if you try. Then it goes on to say, don't bias all of your affections so as to leave her hanging, suspended. Now, some people interpret this to mean, don't bias all your affections towards one wife so as to leave another wife or wives suspended. But the text uses the singular here, which means that it doesn't necessarily refer to a polygamous situation. If we consider carefully and take into account other things that the Quran says about how men are supposed to treat women, what this says is not to keep any woman hanging or pending upon your biased affections or your biased inclinations. Now, the word suspended or hanging also means dependent or conditioned. Now, elsewhere, the Quran says specifically to men, if there's something about your wives you dislike, well, it may very well be that you dislike something, but God has put much good in it. It's true, Jesus. Yeah. Yes. Amen, sister. It's true. So the Quran makes us think about these things, and from this passage we can see that the man is enjoined to appreciate the woman in depth, not just through a biased affection, which would leave her suspended or leave her hanging. Even in a monogamous situation, since a biased affection could change, the woman could never be secure. Now, when the Quran goes to say on, if you can't do justice, then just marry one, it says that would be better for you so that you don't go wrong. Now, the word for going wrong, the same root, also means to have to feed a big family. Now, this reminds me of one of the common prayers of the Blessed Prophet. His wife said he used to pray every day for protection from debt. And his wife asked him why, and he says, well, when a man is in debt, he lies. So here again, I think, is another reflection of the idea that the earth is full, and really the thing to do is not to be fruitful and multiply, but to deal with what we have here. And it says, you know, not to go wrong, and there is this echo of not producing too big a family for you to handle fairly and honestly. Now, I mean, that seems perfectly sensible to me. Now, there is quite a bit, as I mentioned, about how a man should treat a woman. Here's an interesting passage which forbids a man from treating a woman badly in order to induce her to sue for divorce, under which conditions the man would be able to keep some of the dowry. It specifically forbids that. Now, the verb here is kind of an interesting one. It the base form means to become muscular. And it's hard to get a good gloss until we go to another word which is used as an equivalent, dayaka, which means to narrow down, to cramp, to confine, constrain, to make things hard. So we can translate this basic verb as to get tough, actually. So the Quran says that the man is not supposed to get tough with the woman, to try to drive her away, unless, it says, she's guilty of open, obvious outrageousness. And then it goes on to say, but live together, bil ma'ruf, justly. Ma'ruf is an interesting word in Arabic, beautiful word. Technically, it means that which is known, but the meanings and usage are what's universally accepted, what's good, beneficial, fitting, fairness, equity, kindness, friendliness, courtesy. So this is the way in which men are enjoined to live with their spouses. Now, in Islam, the marriage vow as a legal instrument is not till death do you part, as they say in Christian countries. In the Quran, there is very clear provisions for conflict resolution. For example, if the woman fears animosity or distance, coldness from her husband, there's nothing wrong with seeking to come to a settlement. I find the phraseology, if the woman fears, to be very important. Two things. Number one, that the situation is one that is actually threatening to the stability of the home and not just normal human range of moodiness, okay, if the woman fears. And the second thing I get out of this is that it's not to be let go too long, as we see so often here in this country where, unfortunately, you find many good women practicing the Christian teaching of turn the other cheek and wound up getting beaten badly, sometimes even to death. Here, the woman is told to seek some sort of arbitration and settlement if she fears animosity or coldness from her husband. And there's another passage which says, if you, addressing general you, division between the two of them, shikak, division, or split, then appoint arbiters from her family and his family. And it says, if you wish to reconcile, well, God will help you. Now, the word for split here is the same word that's now used in atomic fission, where we split nucleus and this inconceivable, unmanageable power comes out of it and you wind up with poison. Well, I see this in the same way. The splitting of the nucleus of the family, which we see so much here in this country. Look at all the energy it releases. Destructive energy. Uncontainable energy, unmanageable energy, and poisonous waste. So I think that in general, the whole issue of the stability of the family, it's not really an ideological or political issue. It has to do with our life and our survival as a species. So let me turn to the basis of harmony between men and women as taught in the Quran. This is what I would call the basic structure of what the Quran refers to as a noble pair. And this passage, I must ask those of you who don't like linguistics to bear with me, because of all passages of the Quran, this is one of those that most illustrates the literal, technical impossibility of translation, of actual translation. This particular passage is very easy to gloss over, but to translate is actually impossible, and it needs a great deal of attention to each and every word. It starts out by saying, men are caretakers of women by virtue of what God has given more of to one of them than another, and by means of their spending from their wealth. Let me stop there for a moment. And first, to settle any doubts, mention that it is also permissible for a woman to support a man financially. And there is a hadith, a tradition of the Prophet, saying, in answer to the question whether it would be permissible for a woman to support her husband and orphans in her charge as part of charity. And the Prophet said the answer is yes, and she will have two rewards: reward for taking care of relatives and reward for charity. Now let me turn back again to the idea of the man being the caretaker. First, I'd like to look at the word for caretaker. It's kawan. This is most closely related to the second base of the verb kama, which means to accomplish, keep up, take care of, preserve, to attend to watch over. And the second base means to set upright, to lift up, to create, to shape, to arrange well, to do properly, to assess, or to appraise. There's also a related word, kawan, uprightness, straightness, normalcy, strength, vigor, firmness, stamina, consistency, support, livelihood. These are all images of what the supporter is supposed to be. Kawum means true, sound, authentic, firm, solid. Qiyam means accomplishment, performance, undertaking, support, sustenance. So here we have a total image of a supporter, which is not simply material, but has to do with the providing of the whole of the framework of stability of the people, of the family. Now, it's the passage by virtue of by means of what they give of their wealth. It's quite obvious that this is one way in which the men are caretakers of women, by supporting them from their wealth. Before that, though, it says, by virtue of what God has given more to one of them than the other. And when it says one of them, the them is plural. It doesn't say one of the two of them. And it doesn't say which is which, although everyone assumes that it's the man over the woman. Whereas if the text wanted to specify, it could very easily by means of a number of devices. So actually, it looks like it could go both ways. The beauty of it is, though, that it actually works both ways. That if we think in terms of what the man has more than the woman, such as shoulder strength, such as not having to menstruate, for example, well, what should a man do with his extra shoulder strength? You wouldn't want a man to compete with women on that basis, would you? No, to support women, of course. And why? Because of what God has given women that's better than men, namely this quality of mercy and inner sensitivity. That also should be supported and guarded, too. So it's like, if you want to read it this way, and I'm sure there are those who wouldn't agree, but in both senses, both in terms of that which men have more of, and both in terms of what women have more of, that puts the man in a position of protecting the woman. Now, then it goes on to say, now this is the part that you really can't translate, but I'll give a gloss like most people do. And the good woman is obedient. I'll stop right there. It's a fascinating passage because, first of all, the word for good woman, there's no actual noun woman in there. It is I guess you'd call it an adjective. It's really a participle. Tasalihatu. The female version of goodness. See, the emphasis is on the root of sahil, which means good, right, sound, substantial, solid, virtuous, practical, worthy, suitable, valid. The verb, salaha, of which this is an active participle, means to be godly, to be in working order, to be well, to thrive, to be practical, to be appropriate, to match, to fit, to suit, to be valid, to hold true. So, as-salihat, the good women, it doesn't really give this sense of what the text says. It says the true female counterpart. That is to say, the true female counterpart of the Kalam, of that sustainer, the protector, as we just defined, is defined as being obedient. The word for that actually is kalnitat. Kalnitat is, it does mean obedient, but specifically obedient to God. The text doesn't say literally obedient to the husband. It's obedient to God. Of course, that's obviously more important because that's where the real harmony comes from. It's the consciousness of the husband and the wife of their presence, of the presence of God. Now, kalnit, this word they translate as obedient, is the active quality of kunut. And kunut is defined in this way by the prophet, God bless his heart. I think this is so beautiful. The best prayer, he says, excels in kunut. So in other words, this kunut, this quality, which they translate as obedience or humility, is the quality of prayerfulness, the essence, the inner aspect of prayer. And there's another definition of this word as to be humble and obedient to God. And the word that's used for humble here also means to be moved, to be touched. So we have the image of sensitivity to God. This is a very beautiful image of the man as the protector of this inner core of sensitivity to God. Beautiful. Now the text goes on to say, and this is just a continuation, like a definition of this word kalnitat. This passage can be read in different ways according to how can be grammatically construed differently, but we can read it this way, taking in the inner interpretation. Mindful of the unseen, or protecting the unseen, by virtue of the protection of God. This fits very well with the idea of the inner sensitivity to God. Now, the unseen is normally, people usually interpret this to mean the private parts, the external unseen. But the word itself also is used specifically to refer to the divine secret, the supernal, that meaning of unseen. So if we read this in a spiritual sense, we have this image of the protector protecting this inner sensitivity, which is guarding something ineffable by virtue of God's protection. In other words, this inner awareness of God's protection. Now, in Taoism, this is specifically referred to by a very ancient expression, unconsciously and unknowingly following the laws of God. There's also a Buddhist term, the formless discipline of the ground of mind. And this is what this particularly reminds me of. The idea of preservation has to do with the preservation of the purity of heart. And of course, that is really the foundation of all morality and discipline. And what this passage suggests to me is that the woman, and I would theorize through her preparation for the possibility of motherhood, is endowed with this special inner sensitivity that not only can be hooked up, shall we say, to the function of motherhood, but also linked directly to awareness of the divine, of the supernatural. Now I'll say something about the subject of the connubial relationship. This is a little bit hard for people in the West to understand because the association in Christianity between sexuality and original sin, and because there is no apostolic tradition in Christianity for marriage and this type of connubial relations. This, of course, because after Christianity broke off from the matrix of Judaism, it left behind quite a lot of these things which were in Judaism. Anyway, the thing is, in Islam, which seems contradictory to Westerners, is this appreciation of connubial bliss, while at the same time strictly regulating it. Well, the thing is that in secular Western thinking, the connubial relationship is a matter of pleasure. And nowadays, in fact, it's come to be regarded in terms of selfish pleasure, which is really the source of all of the problems that exist here. Whereas in Islam, the pleasure of the connubial relationship is a kind of inspiration to be grateful to God. And so it's treated with actually great reverence. It's as a natural thing, not separated, not made into a thing itself by which it becomes profane, but as part of a relationship which is ordained by the divine and itself sacred. Now, on this subject, the prophet says, the conditions you keep most deserving of complete fulfillment are those by virtue of which you deem private parts permissible to you. That is to say that the conditions, the regulations, which are most worthy, most worth complete fulfillment, are the ones that make the sexual relation
banished from our midst.
Now, how do you want your children to grow up? Just think of the attitudes. I think particularly this is something that the young men of today in this country are perhaps in most need of, this kind of attitude. Now, regarding the issue of the woman's part in the connubial relationship, here again, I think one of the difficulties of understanding is that in the contemporary Western secular thinking, the idea of the woman's enjoyment is actually new, quite new. And this is very different from classical traditions. So there seems to be this idea that no one ever thought of it before. Actually, there is a tradition from the prophet where he is speaking of the connubial relation, and he uses the verb play in this context in the sixth base, which refers to mutuality, a mutuality of play. Furthermore, he repeats the verb twice with a different subject. He says, you play with her, and she plays with you. So you have this image of mutuality, but there's also both are subjects. Now, one thing that the Quran said it does like is unequal is where it says to the men to go to your wives whenever you or as you wish. Another passage says, as you wish, according to the commands of God. But it doesn't say that to the women. That being unequal, according to the political standards of today, I think those people who have actually marital experience understand why this is. If we were trying to explain it outside of the context of politics, we understand, number one, that if this function were controlled solely by the estrous cycle, as we see in the animal world, we'd have a couple of desirable results. One, there would be an excessive fertility rate, and two, there would be a roving promiscuity among the males. Now, another factor to consider is the difference in the internal cycle of the male and the female. The internal cycle of the male, which does exist, is shorter to begin with, even if it's complete, than that of the female. And it's also far more fragile than that of the female. It can be interrupted much more easily, far more easily. That is why, for example, in Taoism, there are a great many exercises devoted to offsetting this fragility of the male cycle. Then there's the fact that if the male is the provider of the family, the male is likely to be out of the house more than the female. So that's one reason why the matter is addressed in this way. In the domain of the difference between male and female, there's also one, there's a very significant factor here. I think everyone, all adults understand intuitively, but nowadays the scientists have actually come up with a chemical tracer of this function, and that has to do with the with chemicals known as pheromones, which arouse the opposite sex. Now there is a difference between male, the transmission of male pheromones and female pheromones. Male pheromones are transmitted only by direct contact, but female pheromones are radiant; they fuse. So there you have it. Well, there again, that's the subtlety of the woman. That's why the Quran doesn't have to tell the woman this. It's written in body. I would say, by the way, now this contemporary research on pheromones was done in the usual scientific way where they actually manipulated people by use of chemicals. Now, of course, this is done under controlled conditions, but just think, if you're susceptible to being manipulated by invisible chemicals, wouldn't you want to have some way of going against it? this might, in short, give us some clue about another function of certain habits of death encouraged by Islam, namely that there is a function of, shall we say, subliminal modesty, not just the modesty of the eye, at least in terms of the transmission of these chemicals. So, we shouldn't judge these things purely in terms of fashion. Now, another fascinating thing about Quranic teachings on the connubial relation, which to me, make me think that they are relevant today, and particularly I wish the young men of today would consider them, regardless of their ideological background. Now, in addition to telling men to go to your wives when you want, and by the way, I suggest, finally, in that discussion, that this is not really a man-woman issue, it's a man-machine issue. That's what I see it anyway. If we think today, the kind of life we live today, how often and how much is our marital relations affected and interrupted by the time clock, by what's going on outside, by the machinery for which we work outside? So to me, this statement, go to your wives when you want, is an affirmation of the centrality of life itself in the Islamic view of life, that the home is the center, and that you work for preservation of the home, which is actually your connection to the divine, rather than the image of the bedroom community, where home is where you rest up, so throughout the next day back to that race. This is what I see in this, which I think is very humane, and certainly not a political issue, though I see very well it could cause misunderstandings if just read out of context and not considered very deeply. Now, some of those conditions are as follows. Man is supposed to do something, it says, for the good of your souls. This means doing good deeds. Now, this is kind of interesting, that it's understood that this relationship is very pleasurable, but it's wrong to experience pleasures of this world as a consumer, not contributing anything. It's part of the idea that there are no rights without duties. So in order to enjoy his relation with his wife, the man is told to do something good for his souls, do good deeds, and be wary of God. That's always there. Now, that obviously affects your relationship. And know that you will meet God. And the consciousness of God is so strong, even in this context. And cheer the believers. Cheer the believers. Gladden the believers. You are supposed to share the joyfulness. That doesn't mean, of course, in the vulgar way that as people speak, but it means to radiate the joyfulness, the harmony, which again to me strengthens the idea that the value of the relationship between the man and woman in this Islam perspective doesn't stop just at that individual couple, but has to do with the good of the whole society. Now, if you think in terms of what we call the atmosphere in a room, you can walk into a room and it seems tense, or you can walk into a room and it seems light or jovial or cold or whatever. We all understand that moods create atmospheres. Well, if we think in terms of the totality of all the people on this crowded earth, we certainly have to consider the value, the events, the pressure, the effect of people's moods. So I see the reverence for the home and good relations between husband and wife in every respect as valuing this as an instrument of producing and nurturing and radiating good mood. And I point out, by the way, this is the reason I say that a lot of the data about what's really happening in the Muslim world is not available to researchers, because it says to gladden the believers. Yeah, right. In other words, people who don't basically are hostile, who don't believe in it, and who are banging down your door trying to find out about your private business, the Quran does not instruct you to answer their questions. Because you wouldn't appreciate it. It's not trying to keep anything back, but it's understanding that there is such a thing as receptivity and the lack thereof. And as Ali said, hearts blind when they're coerced. Now, let me turn to, I'm getting to the end, so don't worry. I want to just briefly touch on the subject of polyandry. Because polyandry is mentioned quite a bit, I find, in books allegedly about Islam and marriage and gender and things like that. There seems to be a tendency to try to number one, portray polyandry as actually the same thing, similar to polygamy, as though they were the same thing, just mirror images of one another. And there's a tendency to glamorize polyandry quite out of context, without examining the types of family relations and types of children were produced by polyandric situations. What we find instead is this image that polyandry is a sexual field day for the woman, just as polygamy is imagined to be a sexual field day for the men. Now let me give an illustration, an actual quotation from a book on subject by a sociologist. This is a woman, and she says, "The compelling duty to provide sexual satisfaction is intelligible only if one is reminded of the fear of unrestrained female sexuality. Curbing active female sexuality, preventing female sexual self-determination, is the basis of many of Islam's family institutes." Unquote. I won't give the author, I don't disgrace this person. It's a fairly typical type of thing, it seems. First of all, I have to say, the compelling duty to provide sexual satisfaction is a rather cynical expression. And I don't think that it's really in harmony with the attitude of reverence that the Quran and Islamic tradition really gives this subject, to suggest, to refer to this in such terms as compelling duty. Now, she says, curbing active female sexuality, preventing female sexual self-determination, is the basis of many of Islam's family institutions. We ask ourselves, if we took away regulations about marriage, would that result in the reality, the capacity of sexual self-determination for men or for women or for anyone? Are there no other conditions, such as the behavior of everyone else? In other words, the idea that if a woman were not subjected to the regulations of Islam, that she would then be able to, then she would have self-determination sexually, is patently absurd, because under any circumstances, or those circumstances particularly, her behavior is going to be influenced by the behavior of all the other women, as well as all the other men. So there would be no such thing as self-determination for anyone. Now, the idea that is that sexual satisfaction as a religious obligation is intelligible only in terms of fear, again, I think is a cynical and actually an unnatural view. I will come to the Islamic view of this in a minute, but from the Taoist point of view, which similarly reveres this relation, we can say right away that there most definitely is another reason for sexual satisfaction. And in Taoist terms, the highest sexual satisfaction is expressed in terms which literally mean attainment of spiritual radiance, attainment of divine light. It might be pointed out that that is also considered the highest peak of all the religious arts. So in that particular context, the connubial relationship is also considered a religious art. And it is not for the purpose of pleasure, but if pleasure is a means of mutual attainment of a higher state, specifically through forgetfulness of the self. Now, as I mentioned, these attempts to glorify polygamy are done without real data. So in order to make my point here and show I'm not being prejudiced as male, I've picked out some writings from a society in which polygamy and polyandry were both practiced, and in which the mores, the sexual mores, were in fact more liberal than they are among secular people in America today. I refer to Tang Dynasty China, which was from about 600 to about 900 AD. That was a special time, and though these mores did change, got much more conservative. During this time, polyandry was accepted, and we have cases, we have actual records of writings of famous women who were polyandrous, in which we can see something about what really happened to them emotionally in these relationships. Now I'm going to read a couple of poems from one of the most famous of all Chinese poetesses, a woman who is said to have been extremely beautiful and very accomplished musician and writer. She was polyandrous. She had several husbands. But other things going on at the same time. And here's what she had to say. This one is titled Thoughts on Winter Night. With painful thoughts, I reach for verse to read aloud by the lamp. I do not sleep the long night, fearful of frigid bedding. A sad wind rises in the leaves, filling the yard outside. Regretfully, the moon has set beyond the window screen. My hope for freedom had, after all, never been quite fulfilled. Through up and downs, I see in vain my true original will. To live in hiding, don't choose a place in easy reach. Evening sparrows twittering uselessly circle the woods. Evening sparrows twittering. Now that refers to all of the men, all the twits, flocked around her, because the assumption was in that society that women, this position, could have any man they wanted. So the men, of course, attracted to her, assuming that he being free and having self-determination, they drove this woman crazy, as a matter of fact. So you see, I mean, there are other factors besides just rules and paper. One, of course, being simply financial factors. If one woman has to work 8 hours a day and another woman is at leisure, do they have the same self-determination or anything? Of course they don't. Now, this particular woman, she didn't have to do her own housework. She had a maid. She had several men to look after her. And yet, because of the society had both polygamy and polygamy, men and women weren't, their domestic situations were not solidified. And there was all of open space or an awful lot of crowding to place. And in other poems, she speaks sadly and scornfully of the moths from the fields circling the guttering lamp. And images like that tear your heart out. Don't do any sort of glamorous image of freedom and self-determination. Now, here's the poem to her righteous man that she was separated from. This is called To My Love Across the River. Wistfully I gaze o'er the river north and south. Empty songs of longing echo memories. Mandarin ducks lays coldly by the sandy beach. Water birds wing lazily through an orange grove. In the mist, the voice of song is hidden subtly. At the ford, the light of the moon sinks deep into the waves. I'm full of emotions so near to you, and yet so far away. Hard to bear ever I hear distant sounds of families on their laundry day. They have it. Here's someone who had all of the social freedoms that are considered so desirable by many people, and yet here she says, harder to bear whenever I hear distant sounds of families on their laundry day. Some people might think, oh, this is Confucian family sentiment, but no. Confucian family sentiment is like this. Confucian family, in Confucianism, is more like an extension of government. The emotional part is not really considered. And yet here, this woman who had all the lovers she could handle, had her chores taken care of, feels even worse when she hears sounds of families on the laundry day. Oh, if we read the Quran, and this makes perfect sense, because it says, and among the signs of God is having created for you mates from yourselves that you may feel at home with them. That's what it says the purpose is. Here again, it doesn't say God created mates so you could populate the earth. It says God created mates from your own selves, from your souls, that you could feel at home with them. That word, which I translate here, feeling at home, has lots of meanings. To be still, to be tranquil, peaceful, calm, at rest. It also means the abiding of the subsiding, disappearance of anger and pain. It means to be assured, to lie, to trust, to have faith, to live, to dwell. So this is what we're doing together. This is what we're supposed to be doing together. It's this conviviality has some special meaning. And it goes on to say, and God placed between you love and compassion. Indeed, love and compassion. Mawadda wa rahma. It doesn't say hawa, which means passion. It does mention the so-called physical or emotional passion. Why is that? Because this hawa is associated with bias and personal selfness. What it says that the place between us, men and women, is mawadda wa rahma, affection. Mawadda is affection, love, friendship. It can cover a range from the platonic to the relation between husband and wife, and rahmah is mercy and pity and compassion. Now, I would suggest that mawadda and rahmah, the love, the affection and mercy, and the feeling at home, Now, one beautiful words that comes from this feeling of home, sakana, saskuno, is sakina. Sakina means home. Sakina means peace, especially divine immanence, peace of the divine immanence. And this is what I see in the Quranic perception for our relationship, is that this is a way for us to draw down the sakina, to experience, participate in the sakina, the divine peace. And that in turn becomes a basis for even further enhancement and development of our nature. Now let me again draw witness from the side. I'm going to return to the Lady Maya, the Buddha's Lady Maya, the mother of Buddha, who here represents in this passage the archetype of a woman. And this passage depicts what Taoists call spiritual intercourse, which is not physical, it's a spiritual intercourse. And this is what I see in the Quran's description of our relationship as being based on mawadda wa rahma, on the affection and sympathy, spiritual intercourse. Now, ordinarily, spiritual intercourse thought of in terms of purity in spirit, but in Taoism it's believed that the spirit can convey vitality, which is a type of energy. And furthermore, that the energy and the vitality is not just energy per se, but that it has some kind of informational content in it. And the classic Tao Te Ching, it says like this, that vitality is very real, has truth therein. And the word means information, true information. Now this hints at a function of the sakina, the peace of the home, as not ending in itself, but to draw therefore again with meditation, the reason that people seek silence and quiet and peace in meditation is to admit inspiration. And there I think we find the spiritual value of the relation of the man and the woman is an instrument of admitting inspiration. And to testify to this from a totally different tradition, I will read from Buddhist scripture, which says that the pilgrim saw Lady Maya in as many ways as atoms in the continent. This is a universalization. Many, many different ways of seeing these qualities of mercy and affection. Seeing her, he magically made his body as extensive as Lady Maya in universalization. And with this omnipresent body, bowed to ubiquitous Maya. In other words, you're respecting these qualities of Rahma everywhere they are. And as he was bowing, here's a critical thing, an infinite variety of concentrations entered into him. He observed those concentrations, making them externally undetectable, cultivating them, mastering them, remembering them, making them all purposive, expanding them, watching them, increasing them, accompanying them, and fixing their impression. So here we have the love and affection, feeling at home, as a means of attaining peace, and the harmonious relation within a peaceful environment as a means of establishing a subtle communication, as is illustrated here, which is between the man and the woman, but at the same time and always in the consciousness of God. So I think if we want to understand why in Islam the woman is sacred to a man, we have to understand most of all this relationship in which we experience mawadda, love and affection, and rahma, mercy and compassion and sympathy, and sakina, peace. And we understand why this is so important for a man, because it is in the process of protecting this inner matrix of enlightenment that we develop our best qualities, our qualities of chivalry, our outward qualities of chivalry, such as valor and patience in adversity. And through our relation with women, we develop the inner qualities of chivalry, which are, in fact, none other than mercy and kindness and a longing for peace.